All right, here we go in 3, 2, 1. What's up, y'all? You make me so, and I don't know if I'm self-conscious, but Josh Allen is sitting next to me, and he always says, "What's up, y'all?" Every time, not every time he sees me, but anyways, here we go.
I yell out, "What's up, Action Josh?"
All right. What's up? What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Governing Bodies and Athletic Training. We have, obviously, Josh Allen here is going to be doing the co-hosting duties, but we have Dr. Leslie Taylor, Tori Lindley, Rusty McCune, and if he can join, Brian Conway. So we got the KD represented, we got the BOC represented, we got the NATA, and then the Education and Research Foundation, if Brian can get on. I'm your host, Jeremy Jackson, obviously Dr. Yellen here right beside me, and the goal of this podcast is to kind of give a brief overview of what each of those governing bodies does and what they don't do, and then we'll go a little bit more into detail about the strategic alliance and how they all work together as one larger cohesive body to promote what we're doing as athletic training. And go ahead, Josh. He's got a there's
happy National Athletic Training Month, everybody. AT's our healthcare.
AT's our healthcare. All right. So without much further ado, everybody, welcome to the show. And I think we're going to start with Dr. Taylor. Why don't you start us off telling us just a little bit, like the Cliff Notes version of who you are and what your organization is and does.
Okay, absolutely. So thank you for having us today. We really appreciate the opportunity. And as you said, I'm Leslie Taylor, and I currently serve as president of the Commission on Accreditation of Athletic Training Education, or the CATE, which is much easier to say. And CATE is the accrediting arm. And so we'll talk more about that. Personally, I live in Lubbock, Texas, and am program director for the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center Master. So that also is a mouthful.
All right. And then let's go to Rusty McCune, right next to Dr. Taylor on the video. So if you're watching the live video, he's the guy wearing the suit and tie. And well, we'll leave the other part that Josh was asking about later. So Rusty.
Well, thank you all, and happy National Athletic Trainers Month. My name is Rusty McCune, and I am currently fortunate enough to serve as the president of the Board of Certification, which is the credentialing body for the profession. And like Leslie said, we'll get into that a little bit more about that later. And my real job for a full-time position, I'm the Sports Medicine Program Coordinator for Nebraska Medicine. As I tell everybody, that job tends to get in the way of what I do for fun, which is obviously being involved with the BOC, the NATA, and helping to do things with and for the strategic alliance partners that we're here with today.
All right, and moving to Rusty's right is Tori Lindley, president of the NATA. So, Tori, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and what you do?
Sure. Josh, Jeremy, happy NATM. Thanks for the opportunity to be here with these three esteemed colleagues. I'm in my 17th year at Northwestern University as the Director of Athletic Training Services, working as a healthcare administrator as well as an educator and a researcher. My role in service currently is the NATA president, and I came to that position with previous experience on the board of directors as the District 4 director, as well as previous service as district president in D4. So really happy to have this opportunity and looking forward to this morning's podcast. Thank you.
Now, before we start to get into it, I want to ask a few questions. Dr. Taylor, can you tell us how long have you been in the athletic training profession?
Oh, so I have been in the athletic training profession since credential holder since 1994. And prior to that, I was from the old internship model at the University of Kansas. And so, yeah, a really long time, close to 30 years.
Okay. Rusty, same question.
Likewise, I was credentialed in 1994 as well. prior to that, I was fortunate enough coming out of high school, we had a certified athletic trainer at my high school. So I actually took her care and prevention of athletic injuries as a freshman in high school and was able to spend my four high school years in the athletic training room at the high school as well. So been in and around it for longer than I can count on my 10 fingers and toes, but enjoyed every minute of it.
Great. Tori?
Sure. I was credentialed, apparently the oldest of the group, in 1991, out of my undergraduate time at Michigan State University. Learned of the profession back in high school, between my sophomore and junior year, in a really small school in northern Michigan. Was lucky to be exposed to the profession by an AT who was teaching a sports med class to a group of us. So really fortunate to be able to be exposed to the profession at a young age, and excited to be a part of it ever since.
Okay. Thank you. So, I mean, we're looking at, between the three of you, close to 100 years of experience. And that's not including Brian Conway, who I think has been a little over 30 years.
Yep.
All right.
34.
So now let's talk about what your respective organizations do and what they do not do. So, Leslie, let's start with you. What does the Katie do? What is their purpose? And okay. What do you not do?
Okay, perfect. So the Katie is responsible for accrediting athletic training programs across the continuum of education. So we accredit professional programs or programs that allow students to enter into the profession and be eligible to sit for the credentialing examination. We accredit post-professional degree programs currently at both the master's and the bachelor's. And I guess I should back up. In the professional programs, we currently are accrediting programs at the undergraduate level and the master's degree level. And so as we approach 2022, that will transition to master's degree programs only. And then we also accredit post-professional residency programs that are housed in both institutions of higher education as well as hospital systems and a variety of other things. So we're looking at the quality assurance of education programs in terms of subjecting themselves to an external review of their quality and their programming.
Okay. And
so that's what we do.
So go back a little bit, because I know there's still some confusion from, or I shouldn't say confusion, but probably a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding from a general, you know, if you're not in athletic training education, then some of this transition is foreign to you. So currently we're at undergraduate and, so I should say the baccalaureate professional program and the graduate professional program levels in terms of education. When's the last time that a graduate program could bring students in?
So the last time that a baccalaureate program can bring students in would be the fall of 2022. So the last time to admit, matriculate students into a program. So the fall of 2022 would be the last time any baccalaureate programs could students could start.
Okay. And we just had Brian Conway join us. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking at your screen, he is to the left of Leslie. I haven't had enough coffee. Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hello. Sorry for the delay.
That's all right. Thanks for joining us. Brian, I'm going to circle back around to you in a little bit.
Sure.
So, Rusty, tell us what the BOC does and what it does not do.
Okay. Well, Leslie spoke about the education programs preparing the students for the credentialing exam, and the BOC is responsible for the administration of that exam and also for the continuing education for our professionals. So we award the ATC credential based upon the successful completion of that exam. And that, in a nutshell, is what we do. We do a lot more than that. I mean, we work hard to advocate for the credential and advocate for what the credential stands for. We work hard with our partners to ensure regulatory standpoint that we're a resource for ensuring that the credential holders can practice to the top of what that credential stands for. What we don't do is we don't accredit programs, education programs. We don't interpret state laws, and we try not to do the jobs and roles of our strategic partners. We try to stay in our lane and ensure that we're all working together to accomplish the same thing, but we take care of credentialing. And I think most recently, what I almost neglected to say was that we're working on developing the specialty certification. And so we'll be working on developing that and providing that so that individuals who pass that exam can say that they're board certified in, you know, in whatever that specialty certification may be. So,
okay, Tori, let's move to you. Tell us what the NATA does and what does the NATA not do?
Well, I think the advantage for NATA is that members have a pretty decent understanding of, you know, what the membership organization is intending to do. I think I would describe it with the three words that outline our overall strategic plan, and that is advocacy, engagement, and development. Advocacy comes in so many different shapes and sizes and so many different forms. As the calendar turned last night into today, NATAM is a really great example of some internal advocacy. From an external advocacy standpoint, there are just a number of programs, you know, 26 plus committees within the NATA volunteers, 48 full-time staff at the NATA office, working on just a ton of great programming around advocating for our great profession. Some of the legislative activity that we've had recently, passing the Licensure Clarity Act, that would be another example, a really good one, of advocacy for the profession and improvement of the brand. In terms of engagement, engagement comes for those of us that consume the annual meeting every year or other programming that's put on by the NATA, where the members have a chance to engage with those that they share like interest. Maybe it's a setting-based interest, maybe it's a clinical-based interest, but engagement with athletic trainers as well as engagement with other healthcare professionals that we work alongside of in interprofessional practice would be great examples of engagement. And then development is the advancement of clinical practice by our members. And so multiple opportunities provided by NATA every single year. NATA is the largest CEU provider, a continuing education provider for athletic trainers on the planet. And there's just so many different great examples of development. But development also comes from the journals. So the JAT, the Education Journal, the Legal Digest, and so a number of really cool publications that the NATA is involved with as well, in addition to the development of ATs within their own clinical as well as educational practice. What the NATA doesn't do has basically been stated, and Brian will give the third thing that the NATA doesn't do. I think while we're unique as well as we're envied by other healthcare providers and other practitioners in sports medicine space, is that we have the CATIE, who accredits our programs and sets incredible standards for programs to keep. We have the BOC, and so we have a separate organization for the accrediting body, a separate organization for the credential holder, and as mentioned by Rusty, a future credential and a future board certification to come, and then Brian will talk about the areas around research and development and scholarship, and that's the other area that we love the experts and the other three partners to manage. So those would be the things we don't do.
All right, so let me ask you a question, right? As you outline these three specific goals, advocacy, education,
engagement
and development, right?
Yes.
So that's AED. Was that intended to spell out AED or no?
I'll tell you what, you've had enough coffee because we did not get that one past you, Josh.
That's what a doctoral degree does for you, Tori. That's all right, Brian, let's swing back around to you. Okay,
well,
and
great.
We're going to catch you up here. One is, how long have you been in the profession? So how long have you been credentialed?
Oh, I've been credentialed.
So since what year?
Since 84. So
you got them all beat.
College in 84.
Okay. And then, so tell us what the foundation, and that's a question that I think some people have, right? So, I understand it to be the foundation. Some other people still find it to be the REF. So is it the foundation? Is it the Research and Education Foundation? What is the appropriate name?
We go on a normal basis by the NATA Foundation.
Okay.
And, you know, going to our mission statement, we talk about champion research, support education, enhances knowledge to optimize clinical experiences and outcomes within the diverse patient population served by the athletic training profession. So we're the philanthropic arm of the Strategic Alliance of the profession. And Tori mentioned scholarship, research grants, different educational initiatives. We try to fill that void for the profession.
And what, so that's what the foundation does. What doesn't the foundation do?
Well, really what our strategic partners do. And I think a lot of times, you know, Tori, I think stated it correctly. I think a lot of folks think that the NATA Foundation is part of the NATA, which it's not. It is a separate organization. We really strive to make sure that we drive the research, the education, the scholarship for the profession. So whether you're talking about certification or membership or accreditation, we don't touch in any of those areas. I think we're great partners to each one of those organizations.
And so collectively, let me ask you all a question. So these four organizations collectively make up what's called the AT Strategic Alliance. And when I brought AT Strategic Alliance up to some of the other athletic trainers in and around the greater Houston area, I was surprised to learn that there were a few that still have not heard of the AT Strategic Alliance. So if we can kind of go around, and can you give a brief history of how that AT Strategic Alliance was formed? So obviously you all are, if I were looking at it as a business, all of you own 25% of, you know, the overall organization. And so how was this AT Strategic Alliance formed? And is that a common factor in other healthcare professions? So I'll throw it out to whoever wants to jump in first.
Well, I'll try. And I think my other colleagues are much more eloquent than I am. But I think it started a number of years ago to bring the different facets of our profession together, to work together, to make sure that we supported each other's missions, and we drove or helped lead the profession forward, that each organization stays in their own lane and supports the profession in its own way. And Tori or Leslie or one of you might be able to explain that a little bit more eloquently.
Well, I'm not sure about eloquent, but I can tell you we have a really cool logo. So if nothing else, check that out. But I think as we've stated, the uniqueness here, unlike other healthcare professions, is that we are allowed to independently manage the areas that we've already described. And so if everybody's pushing and advancing the profession forward, there has to be some level, a high level of synergy among the four different areas, so that when we talk probably around what you're going to potentially ask next, you know, we're thinking about the future of the profession. We're thinking about how some of the development and advancement of athletic training into the future involves, you know, each of us. We talked about staying in our lanes, but, you know, the reality is there's advocacy that's going on in all four of our organizations. There's a real focus on education in all four of our different areas, but we approach it from a little different angle. If the four presidents and the executive directors for all four organizations aren't consistently talking and managing issues and assuring that we communicate openly and we're on the same page, then we either stall with projects or we find ourselves, even worse, diverting on some projects where we really have to have synergy among the four leaders.
Right. So along those lines, is there a managing director of the AT Strategic Alliance itself, or is it the four presidents of the different agencies that you all kind of manage yourselves as the alliance?
I'll jump in on that one. And again, I've been accused of a lot of things, but Eloquent has never been one of them, but we're going to shop there. There is not a managing director. You know, the AT Strategic Alliance really is just a collaborative effort of all four of the arms of the profession coming together to try to ensure that the profession is moving forward symbiotically, you know, making sure that we're capitalizing on each other's strengths, sharing resources where we can share them, but also identifying those areas that each of us specifically are geared towards fulfilling our mission and the purpose and priorities of our organization. When we come together, it really is a group that we look at what is best for the profession. We look at, you know, we look at how each of us can fulfill the roles in accomplishing what we view as the future of the profession. But really, there isn't. We all take turns in providing, setting up agendas. We take turns in hosting meetings. It is a shared responsibility amongst all of us. You know, between the presidents and the executive directors and CEOs of each of the organizations, we all work together to make sure that that we're doing what we set out to accomplish. And like has been stated, what we're trying to accomplish is to ensure that from a, you know, across the globe, that the profession of athletic training is recognized for what we are as healthcare providers and continuing to move forward in a positive fashion.
So I'm going to swing back around and I'm going to start off with Tori. Tori, we're heading into 2020, and along with this direction, we're moving to the professional master's degree. And as we start to look forward as far as vision and future, we throw that line out to 2030. So by 2030, in your mind, what does the athletic training profession look like?
Well, I'll give a couple of things that I believe. I want to leave some of those answers for Dr. Taylor and others, because, you know, this is something we talk a lot about. And when we think about what the profession may look like, we are all tremendously encouraged about how the changes we've made in the professional degree, the post-professional educational options, the way that we're moving in a really positive direction to enhance transition to practice for athletic trainers and others that my colleagues will give that look like healthcare. And when we look like healthcare and we educate that way and we do that in a way both the professional as well as post-professional educational tracks, we're going to continue to advance in the level of respect and the kind of identity that we deserve within the healthcare market. And I think I'll close this section and open it up for Dr. Taylor just to say that ATs will continue to evolve based on our awesome skill set into different areas of practice. And, you know, practices will continue to emerge. Many have emerged. And that's what's really cool about our skill set. And we don't anticipate that that's going to stop. So many great new opportunities for ATs just based on all the hard work that we've done over the course of the last decade and really the last 5 years.
It's all right. So I'm going to jump over to Leslie. Leslie, I want you to add on to what Tori said. And so from your perspective as president of the KD, where do you see us in, obviously over the next few years, but jumping forward to 2030, what does that look like from the KD's perspective, do you think?
We have programs that are all at the master's degree level or the graduate degree level. And with that comes the new set of standards. We have new professional standards that go into place for graduate programs in 2020, but also the new curricular content, which is the skills and knowledge that programs need to teach, that will also apply to baccalaureate programs as they teach out. So I think that, you know, Tori alluded to some of those advancements in terms of what that curricular content looks like. And I know personally, I'm really excited about how that's going to help move the profession forward. There's, you know, some new, some advanced topics. There's really focusing more on things related to business practices as well as the hands-on care. And I think those are really important skills and knowledge for our future practitioners to have. So I think by 2030, we'll start seeing how the graduates of programs using that are going out into the world and what they're doing. I think the other thing is that we'll have a better handle by 2030 on really where are those post-professional degree pathways. So right now we have both master's degrees and DAT programs. And there's a lot of conversation about what that space looks like. The KD believes in accreditation of that space, and we want to support programs in that space, working very closely with the NATA and the PPEC, the posting committee through the NATA in that space. But I think that, as well as an increase in number of residency programs that are preparing students or residents, really are going to help get to this idea of the advanced clinical practitioner. And ultimately a clinical specialist, somebody who sits for the board of certification. And I want to take Rusty's time with that. But I think we're going to see the profession and the skill set and the level of practice continue to increase. And that's not that everybody has to do some sort of post-professional education, that they have to get a board, be board certified in something, but it really allows all of our clinicians who hold that ATC credential to start thinking about what are they going to do next in terms of continuing or just advancing their personal knowledge skill.
Rusty, I'm going to throw it to you.
Okay. There's been some good lead-in conversations, some good lead-in topics. Leslie threw out developing the clinical specialist, and obviously we mentioned earlier the specialty certification with the development of the specialty council under the BOC. We're looking at developing that first specialty certification in orthopedics. The thing I think, that like Leslie said, that it's not something that every athletic trainer is going to have to do, but I think it is something that for those who want to take a deeper dive into a specific area, it provides that opportunity and provides the opportunity for them to be recognized for for advancing their skills and knowledge in a specific area. I hope that in 2030, part of us looking like healthcare providers and being like healthcare providers means that we're taking an active role in continuing to advance our own skills, being responsible for maintaining and obtaining those expertise that we claim to possess, and ensuring that as we deliver the services that we provide, that we're delivering them at the top of our skill set. And I think that for those that were at the JCM meetings in Dallas, joint committee meetings in Dallas, we gave a presentation that kind of talked about this. And now, from a BOC standpoint, I think one of the things that the taglines that was used that I like is, we stop counting the CEUs and start making our CEUs count, because I think that especially as we start to evolve and start to grow and start to expand in other areas of health and our educational preparation becomes is expanding, we need to make sure that we are targeting the areas that we internally recognize as areas that need to be developed, and stop focusing on necessarily everything that we're good at, and start ensuring that we are fulfilling our roles and responsibilities of being that expert in providing healthcare to the physically active. So that's where I, from our perspective, that's where I hope that we are in 2030.
And so, and then Brian, I'm going to throw it over to you here in a second, but I got a follow-up question for Rusty. If we look, act, and behave like medicine, then that would say if our first specialty certification is going to be in orthopedics, then do you see other certifications coming down in emergency medicine, pediatrics, primary care, possibly neurology, those types of areas?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that, we talked about the strategic alliance making a concerted effort and a collaborative effort in advancing the profession and in advancing what we're trying to, the message that we're trying to convey. And I think that to your question and to that that mission that the Strategic Alliance has expressed, in addition to the specialty certification in orthopedics, the Strategic Alliance has committed to exploring and developing two additional specialty certifications. Again, it's in the very early stages, but you know, I think that topics such as pediatrics and rehabilitation come to the top of the list. If you look at the list that the Katie has provided in their list of focus areas, and Leslie, I probably titled that wrong, I apologize, but I mean, there's an entire list that includes behavioral health, wellness, pediatrics, rehabilitation. And so I think that we could look to perhaps see some more of those, but definitely the Strategic Alliance and as a group has committed to developing additional specialty certification opportunities.
Okay, Brian, I'm gonna throw it to you.
Yeah, our job as we move towards clinical specialists is have the support of the research and the education that goes along with that. And it's imperative for us as a foundation. Our board has been working really hard in the last 4 years to kind of change our financial makeup. In the past, the foundation has been, and people don't like it when I say this, kind of a money in, money out. Money in for scholarships, money out for scholarships. Money in for grants, money out. A number of years ago, we had a capital campaign where we have developed many endowments, and we have a lot of endowments right now, but those are restricted funds, so they can only be used for what they were intended. Well, to support the profession going forward, the foundation needs to have unrestricted funds that we can use to help with these projects. And our board's done an amazing job in the last few years of getting us ready to be able to provide that support. We are not quite there, but we're getting there. And our job is to create an unrestricted strategic fund to be able to support these initiatives.
Okay. I got an overall question for the four of you, and then I have a question from one of our listening members for you.
We have one listener? Fantastic.
Wow.
We have one.
No, on that, there's Brendan, Patrick, I know Scott Arsenault over in Louisiana, and
hey, Scott.
Brandy Curry listening live. There's some more there, but those are the ones I can see right this second.
All right, so the overall question that I have, right, this is coming from Josh, is that, because I hear it all the time from some athletic trainers in and around the Houston area. For those that are the naysayers of the profession moving to the professional master's degree and what that is going to do or not do for the profession, what are each of your responses to that?
Well, I'll start. I think that first of all, it's important for people to remember that this was not a rash or singular decision, that you know, each of the Strategic Alliance boards studied this, the profession studied it, and then a collective decision was made independently by our boards. And so, you know, I think that one of the concerns I hear is just made the decision. And it really was a profession-based decision. And so I think just a reminder of that is important. And the other thing I think is, if you look at us wanting to be with healthcare, we are healthcare. ATs are healthcare, as we're going to hear a lot this month, and everybody should already believe. I think that we have to remember that we need to be cohesive with our healthcare counterparts. If you look at the amount of education and the knowledge and skills that we're asking our students to have these days, it really is worthy of a master's degree, from the top of it to the breadth and depth of it. And so I think that you look at it in terms of what are the expectations of the students and our incoming practitioners.
All right, I'll throw it out to, I'm going to move over to Brian. Brian, what?
Could you ask the question one more time? I was having some power difficulty, so I had to move to a cord. So I apologize.
No, that's okay. So for those that are questioning the move to the professional master's degree, what is your response to them? And how do you defend the move? Essentially, is the question.
Well, as a NATA foundation, I don't know that we have an official response other than we support the Strategic Alliance and the partners and the decisions that have been made. Personally, to me, it's a way to continue to move our profession forward. And, you know, and I think some of my colleagues have used the word look like healthcare. I think it allows us to look more like healthcare.
Okay. Rusty, I'm going to throw it over to you.
So, similar to Brian, from a true BOC perspective, I think that there's, you know, the role that we recognized playing in that decision was to really evaluate what the information that's being provided and support our strategic partners in that move. The exam that we provide is based on the practice analysis, and so we'll be seeing how what is taught in the education program gets integrated into practice, and how that will impact the exam is yet to be seen. But you know, I think ultimately it's an opportunity for us to support our strategic alliance partners. Now, personally, like Brian and Leslie stated, I think it's a good opportunity to continue to advance our skill set and advance our ability to do things. And I think that there's some of those skills that are better acquired at the master's level or can be more efficiently provided at the master's level if we capitalize on that opportunity.
Okay. Tori, I'm going to throw it to you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Just to pile on what's been said a little bit, I believe it's probably in the top three of the most important decisions that we've made as a profession. It was done, as Leslie described, in a very intentional way. And so it cannot be understated how critical that decision to move the professional degree will have, how important that's going to be for our profession. As a member or as an athletic trainer, the default position really should be supportive. Wasted energy on, you know, negativity around the decision that's already been made and the opportunity that we have looking forward. We are going to produce, based on the standard changes as well as other opportunities to improve the way that preceptors approach clinical education, we are going to produce a different graduate in a wildly positive way. And as we've already stated, the change in the professional degree leads to the opportunities for the post-professional degree changes. The change in the professional degree leads us to an opportunity to do transition to practice, as we talked about before, in a way that we've never done before. So the professional enhancements are crazy good. Stack on top of that, what Leslie alluded to is now we're on an equal playing field with our allied healthcare partners. And what that does for us legislatively, what that does for us in so many other advocacy opportunities is to show and identify that the degree, the professional degree at the master's level, again, puts us in a side-by-side ability to show that interprofessional practice in the way that we will and want to collaborate with other healthcare providers. It just gives us that opportunity. And so excited about the changes for the opportunity that we have now to produce a different graduate and a graduate that's going to not only push us forward and advance our, as Rusty said earlier, we all want to work at the top of our skill set. So educational changes advance the way that we practice, and scope of practice improves as our education advances.
All right. We have a question from one of our listening viewers, and it's from Tim Acklin. And I'll throw this out to whoever wants to answer it. Will there come a time in the near future where ATs who do not have a master's or doctorate be required to do so to maintain their certification?
Smells like Rusty's going to answer that one.
was going to say, BOC all the way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at this time, you know, as far as maintaining the certification, in order to become certified, you have to graduate from a CADI accredited program. You have to sit for the certification examination. The maintenance of that certification is reliant upon CEU completion. You know, you're completing your CEUs and fulfilling those. At this point in time, there is nothing that we've talked about that would be reliant solely or dependent solely upon the degree that you've received. Once the standards have changed, and once I think Leslie, like you said, 2022, 2024, after that, you know, then it will be reliant upon those students going forward that graduate from those CADI accredited programs will have those master's degrees. But you know, as far as anybody before that, the maintenance of your certification is not reliant upon the degree that you've received. It's reliant upon fulfilling the continuing education and maintenance of certification requirements that are established.
Okay. Do we have any other questions from members?
Just a second, go ahead.
We're good? All right, I got a few more questions here. And this is just coming from me. At some point, you know, if I look at other healthcare professions, PT, PA, even nurse practitioner, chiropractic, etc. If I reference PT, they have this kind of vision 2020 that all PTs will have a professional doctoral degree, and that's how they're going to enter the profession. And there have been some practicing physical therapists that either came out with a master's in PT or a bachelor's in PT that have kind of jumped to that professional PT, and there have been these different routes to do that. So, and I'll throw this out to whoever wants to answer it. Do you see a point in time where there's going to be a demand for practicing athletic trainers to graduate from these accredited programs, go on for residencies, and then go on for these post-professional advanced practice DAT degrees? Is that do you think that's where we're going to be heading in 2030?
Well, I'll start with that, and I'll let my friends in the Strategic Alliance answer as well. But, you know, I think that it really is a personal professional development plan for individuals and what they're interested to do. I don't think that there's one set route that clinicians will need to take. I think having the opportunity for DATs, for maybe fellowships in the future. That's not happening tomorrow. That's not a vote that's been taken, but it is a conversation when you look at it. But I think it really is about what's the interest of the individual. Now, from an employment standpoint, will we get to a point that employers are going to be looking at that? you know, hopefully we're going to start looking at healthcare in terms of, you know, what I just lost my train of thought, but it's okay. I'm not eloquent either, Brian. but no, so that, you know, you're hiring people because of their skill set and their advanced area of practice, not just solely based on that they have an ATC credential. Maybe the need for generalists, absolutely. But maybe you have a mix of people at your organization that really look at the generalist and then, you know, somebody who has that advanced training or that advanced clinical practice. And I don't know that it's a linear progression. I think there will be people who will want to do residencies. I think they will do a DAT, but for very different purposes. And so, I don't know that it will become a mandate ever, but I think that it is just a conversation that will be up to the individual's professional development plan.
Okay. Anybody else want to add to this?
I think the answer is no. So I would certainly agree with Leslie. I think the opportunity for the DAT is just one of the post-professional educational opportunities to advance clinical practice that we've talked about along the lines of the accredited residencies and the opportunities for the future in accredited fellowships. I think she also touched on what I believe is way more important that we focus on between now and 2030, and that's being able to identify what the value is of those post-professional opportunities. What's the value of the board certification that the BOC is working to develop in orthopedics, and then in the future, board certifications, you know, what are the values for employers and helping them to understand and educating them on what that means, so we can show the bump and the return on investment through salary. It'll be in other ways, in fulfilling practice and, you know, having a job that really fulfills you is critical, and quality of job is really important. But we all have rent and mortgages and want to be supportive of our lives. And so the value that employers need to understand better for the post-professional degrees is where we're also focusing on as an alliance to show what that is and to get it out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rusty?
I don't know that I can really add a whole lot to that other than, you know, like Leslie said, the it's going to be about identifying areas that an individual wants to gain further knowledge in, but also recognizing the fact that the ATC credential is that strong foundation upon which we launch our professional careers. And so, what the specialty certifications and advanced training will allow is the opportunity to, as we find ways to demonstrate value and hopefully see that value reflected in numerous ways, those individuals that choose to pursue that will be, there'll be a return on investment for seeking that, rather than just acquiring more knowledge and not seeing a return on that and leaving someone perhaps wondering, why would I do this? So, you know, it's a process, but, is it something that is going to be standard and required? I would agree. I don't foresee that at this point in time. I think it's an opportunity. Yeah. Rather than a directive.
Tell me some of the emerging opportunities in athletic training that are really exciting to you. I'm seeing some opportunities that seem like every week there's something new that's coming out of the profession. So give me some areas of clinical practice that you all are seeing from your 30,000 foot view.
Well,
that are exciting to you.
Yeah, more than even just clinical practice, I'll hit on some of those. But, globalization of the profession is a huge opportunity. And then we're on the verge of making some really incredible breakthroughs in the way in which athletic trainers are valued. So a number of different projects. There's a accountable care organization project ongoing currently to identify AT value. There's a ton of work being done from coast to coast with third-party payer initiatives where we're identifying how athletic trainers fit in with insurance company payers in some settings. Again, not the identification that every setting should be billing, but in those that can, doing that at a really high level. All of that leads to the North Star of CMS recognition, which will really accelerate the advancement of the profession, the value of athletic trainers in a lot of different settings. So I would highlight those as really exciting advancements and new opportunities. And then I'll leave my colleagues to talk about some of the different settings that have emerged, but also that we are likely to emerge into just based on our awesome skill set.
And Tori, before you hand it off, that's one of the benefits of moving to the professional master's degree is that CMS will not reimburse for baccalaureate level providers, correct?
Ding.
Thank you. I've had good coffee this morning. Okay. Only took me an hour, but now I'm throwing fire. Rusty?
I think that the one that popped into my head initially was the globalization. I think there's some fun opportunity and some neat opportunities from a global standpoint. Obviously, each of us will have a different role. Each of the strategic alliance partners will have a different role in that as it grows. But I do think that there's some opportunity there. If you're looking specifically at settings, and I think the settings and the professional opportunities and locations in which we can capitalize on our skill set is just immense, and I think it's endless. And I think that about the time you think you've heard someone that has broken into an area that, wow, that's really pushing it, you hear something else. So, I mean, whether we're looking at the performing arts, some of the extreme sports, the clinical practices, I think that there's just a number of different ways that we can that we're finding that our skill set fits, and we're prepared to enter these settings and these opportunities, but I think too that comes our responsibility to ensure that we're prepared to enter those settings and prepared to fulfill the obligations that come with working in those opportunities. And so while I'm extremely excited about these, and I think that the world is open to us as professionals to capitalize on our preparation and our education, I think that we have to, that's where it comes back to that professional responsibility as well as an alliance responsibility to ensure that we're preparing ourselves to enter into those markets so that we can have those expertise that we want to share and that we proclaim to have.
Okay. He muted up.
Okay. Does that mean I'm up? I think you're not.
He's still talking, but nothing's coming out.
No, that's that's Facebook.
Oh, sorry.
yeah, sorry. More coffee, please. All right, let's go ahead.
Okay. So I think that when I was at the Joint Committee meeting in January for the NATA, one of the things that I heard that I liked the most was that we talk about these emerging settings, but really using more of an alternative setting because they're not really emerging anymore, some of those that we think of as emerging. And if we start naming specific sites, we're absolutely going to leave somebody out. I think there is a lot of opportunity. I think, public safety is an area you hear more, but really just looking at how can our practitioners best use their skill set and their interests to meet the needs of a physically active population. And there's a lot of opportunity out there and a lot of really exciting movement happening, I think. And I think back to when I was where the profession has come since I started as an undergraduate baccalaureate student, and I love it. I think that's what keeps it interesting, and it keeps it engaging for people. And again, going back to that, we are healthcare. The more we believe we're healthcare, and the more the others recognize that we're healthcare, it continues to open up just a wealth of opportunities in varying settings and with patient populations.
All right, I do have
back in, on that, because I think we can talk about the settings that have emerged and highly successful AATs in those settings, some future growth in telemedicine, emergency medicine, where we're established in some communities and can be much more established in others. But the Alliance is focused and remains focused on advancements in the areas that we have been in for a long time. And so secondary schools is an area where we still have 34% of high schools who are not served by a healthcare provider in the form of an athletic trainer. And if you do the math and think about how many student athletes and how many physically active youth that is, that's a lot of underserved athletes who need athletic training and healthcare services. So that's still a primary focus. But then simply looking beyond at the secondary school level, at the collegiate level, for the quality of the jobs that we currently have. And quality improves drastically when you have more hands and when you have more qualified healthcare providers. So the second and third athletic trainer in schools that have ATs already, the rising expectations of standard of care at the college setting requires that more healthcare providers are given the opportunity to make an impact on healthcare in that setting. And then we haven't even talked about youth sports. And, let's think about the hundreds and thousands of soccer tournaments that go on every single weekend. And that's just picking one sport.
Yep.
So we've got some real good opportunities with the youth sports governing bodies to advance athletic training. They love our skill set, and they're really interested in finding out ways to connect more with athletic trainers so that our youth sports and then our club sports at the college level and our club sports at the high school level, really the opportunities are endless in the areas that we're already and have had really strong connection to for well over 60 years.
All right, I do have another question from Facebook. This is Kelly Stetzer. She asked, will ATs ever be able to call themselves healthcare professionals on their own so that we can own our knowledge and skills? And this is kind of in regards to like a nurse practitioner may be able to work like in their own clinic, but a physician assistant might not be able to work in their own clinic. And so I think that is the question is, are we headed in that direction as athletic trainers?
I'll try. I don't think we're headed in that direction. I think ATs work really, really well autonomously. However, there is a desire and a need, and Rusty can talk about, you know, the regulation because they're most closely tied with the regulatory side and state practice acts. But, you know, the autonomy that ATs have is tremendous in a lot of our settings. But we also really value the connection that we have to our physicians and our physicians in multiple different areas of practice, primary care, family practice, you know, sports medicine fellowship trained physicians, orthopedists, subspecialists. So we have a really strong point of care and strong connection from a referral standpoint, as well as, you know, carrying out some of the standing orders that we have with our physicians. So right now the connection that we have to the docs is super strong, and I don't anticipate that changing or that direct access is necessarily a direction that we would want to go in as a profession.
Yeah, I think that, you know, ultimately it's going to fall back to your state license or your practice act, what you're allowed to do within your state. You know, the standard VOC standards say that we work under the direction of or in collaboration with. And as we start looking at trying to develop model language, I think that, you know, we still talk about working in collaboration with or under the direction of physicians. Does that mean that we can or cannot open up our own clinics on the side? Again, I think it comes back to what does your state practice act say? What does it allow you to do? Does it allow for direct access? Does it allow for those types of opportunities? And that will define really what we can and cannot do legally. And I think that would be, you know, finding ways to work within what your legal boundaries are is going to drive a lot of that. I think that there's some creative opportunities that we have. As Tori mentioned, that autonomy is something that we do very well with, but we do work as part of interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary teams. And I think that that's going to be an important thing to remember and to recognize as we move forward, is the value of those teams. And so while we want to recognize our ability to work autonomously, I think that we need to, you know, my personal opinion is we need to continue to recognize the strength of the members of our healthcare team and the value that each of those team members bring, and not necessarily look to set ourselves out practicing just by ourselves. But while we are capable of it, doesn't necessarily always mean that that's what we should strive to do.
Okay. Leslie, you want to add to any of that?
Well, I think that Rusty and Tori have covered that really well. And really just, as Rusty said, making sure that you're going back to what the Practice Act says, and that you're not violating any standard of care that governs you, both from a state perspective or the credential.
Okay.
There was a question from Joseph Hernandez, and he was saying he wanted some clarification on kind of these changes and things like that. And I'm not exactly sure of the question, but I know that I have the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/strategic alliance, which links to the page where the NATA has the strategic alliance. So Joseph, if that helps, you can go to sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/strategic alliance, and then that will send you over to where they are, and then it'll tell you a little bit more about each of those and what they do. And if that doesn't help you, then you can message me and I can get a hold of them. Or obviously you can reach out to any one of them on here.
Hey, Brian's back.
Ryan's back.
Hey, Brian, welcome back.
Oh, I got him muted.
What happened or what I did.
Well, we missed you. We missed a lot of conversations. And I'm not smart enough to go back and remember what all the questions were. But we're happy that you're back. So, do we have any more questions from...
Not at this time.
We have any more questions. All right, so I think that we're going to start to wind this thing down. And as we do, are there any parting words that you think are important for our listening audience to know about the Strategic Alliance, about your individual organizations, about the direction of the profession, and some things that the general athletic training population needs to know? Because, you know, it's hard, right? I'm in athletic training education, so I know a lot about the Katie. And I know, you know, I know a little bit about the NATA, obviously not as much as some others, but and I know somewhat about the BOC and a little bit about the foundation. But any parting words about where the profession is going, your individual organization's roles, what the general membership should be looking out for, et cetera?
I'll start if that's okay.
Yeah.
Number one, these three other presidents of the other organizations with the Strategic Alliance are unbelievably talented people who have strong boards that work hard to move our profession forward, along with the foundation's board. So I think our profession is unique in that we have four organizations that are trying to use an old Health South term, pull the wagon together to move the profession forward. So I'm excited about that. Secondly, from a foundation standpoint, I'm going to get on a soapbox just a second. You know, in our profession, 6% of our members have directly to the foundation. So that means that they are making a conscious effort to donate to the foundation. That is not they bought a ticket to an event, they bought an item at the silent auction, they have made a donation directly to the foundation. 6% is extremely low for a foundation. As I go out and talk to folks outside our profession to try and raise money, raise awareness, one of their first questions to me is, what percentage of your members donate? And when I say 6%, their eyebrows go up and they go, so you're asking me to support your foundation, but your members aren't. So we have to do a better job. And it doesn't matter what people give. It can be $1, it can be $100. We have to get that number from 6% up over 25%. And that help us grow the foundation, help support the profession, and support the Strategic Alliance Initiative. So as a foundation, that's one of our goals, is to create awareness, get that number up over 25%. Once someone gives to the foundation, it's on us to show value. They show, if we show value, they'll continue to give. So that's my soapbox speech for the foundation.
Brian, let me ask you a follow-up question to that. If I were to compare it to other healthcare professions that are on the same parallel as where we are and where we're going, like what does PT do? What does PA do when they're collecting money for the foundation? What does their membership give?
I don't know exactly. I know PT from a discretionary dollar amount is way above what we do. I do not know their percentages. I know their percentages are above 25%.
Okay. And what about PA? Do you have any
I don't know individual numbers.
Okay. Leslie, any parting words from you and Katie?
Well, so again, thank you for the opportunity. And I think one of the things that is really important, and hopefully these opportunities show that, is that we all, while we're individual organizations, do work so, so well together. We have regular conference calls. We have regular that we really can work together to strengthen the profession as well as our individual organizations. And so I think knowing the relationships that we, the four of us have and our boards have with each other is really important for the membership and just the credentialed athletic trainer and the public to know that is something that we are committed to and that we really do work hard and collectively together. I think from a Katie perspective, you know, I'm using kind of the theme right now of change is here, change is coming, and change is hard. There's a lot of changes in athletic training education right now. And if you have questions, I would just encourage people to reach out. Contact the Katie office, contact me, but ask questions. I think it's much better to ask questions and get an answer than to speculate. And so, you know, we're excited about the direction of athletic training education and the implementation of the new professional standards in A20, the move to the graduate degree, master's degree in the fall of 2022, as well as the advancement of residencies and, you know, collaborating with the Strategic Alliance on the specialty certifications. So a lot of good things happening.
Leslie, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's going to be the best way for them to reach out to Katie?
Certainly, support@katie.net. would be the best way to get a hold of the office and then in turn me.
Okay, Rusty, same question goes to you as we close down. Some parting words on behalf of the BOC.
First of all, I just want to thank you for having us all today. I think, you know, if we talk about the Strategic Alliance, I think that you said it in your opening statement that there's still individuals who aren't aware of the Strategic Alliance or aware necessarily of what our purpose and role and function is. So I think something like this is extremely beneficial and extremely important to help get the message out to our stakeholders and our members so that people understand what we are doing, what we're trying to accomplish. I think from a BOC perspective, we've got a lot of neat things happening. I think the Specialty Council, we're working on some international initiatives with our mutual recognition agreement with Canada and Ireland right now. So there's some things coming down the pike, that are exciting from a credentialing standpoint. But, you know, again, I think it's just the synergy of the organizations working together is only going to help to advance what we're all trying to do individually and advance the profession collectively. So thank you for taking this time to help spread the message about the Strategic Alliance and the things that we're all doing individually and collectively.
And then the best way to get a hold of you or the BOC?
Just go through the best ways to just go to the website, bocatc.org. And that will, the office is going to, they've got actual people that answer the phone on the office. The shout out to the folks at the BOC offices because they do a tremendous job. Our staff is second to none. So they will do everything they can to help provide answers to your questions. And if they don't have the answer for you directly, they'll make sure that they find it. So,
Tori.
Yeah, Jeremy and Josh, thank you for this really cool opportunity today, but also thank you for everything that you both do to advocate for our great profession. I look forward to seeing everyone in Las Vegas. Our meeting is going to be, as good as it's ever been. With opportunities for networking among different settings and, again, different patient populations, but also the cutting edge for where we are in terms of continuing education and a great program that will be put forward in late June. In terms of, the alliance, the strength of this group, I think, has been demonstrated today. The relationships and the collaboration are at an all-time high. That benefits our profession tremendously. And will continue to benefit our profession tremendously. We all utilize different communication channels, but I would kind of put everything back in one area and emphasize how important the NATA news is. Each of the strategic alliance partners is offered the opportunity to have space in the NATA news whenever they need it, and they run periodic updates. And there's so much good information. Advice that I give young professionals and students all the time is really simple. They need to read. And if they read their NATA news, and if they stay up to date with what the research is showing with our journals and other journals, our entire profession will be better. So I think from a communication standpoint, more information about the alliance from the alliance can always be found in NATA news. And then, as always, NATA.org is a real important hub for all athletic trainers, members. And then atyourownrisk.org is a great external facing website for athletic trainers who want to advocate on behalf, especially in the youth sports space. And if they're interested in helping parents be advocates for the profession, atyourownrisk.org is a great website as well to have parent groups and other advocates outside of athletic training get behind athletic training and push for that second athletic trainer in a high school or that athletic trainer to be out on those youth lacrosse fields. So two great websites. And as always, anybody can email me at any time or do something crazy, like pick up the telephone and call. Always willing to talk.
Before I toss it back over to Brian for his contact information, Tori, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Oh. And give me a 30-second elevator pitch as to why athletic trainers are valuable and why they're needed in healthcare.
In healthcare in total?
Yeah. Why would an organization want to hire an athletic trainer? Let's say it's in the secondary school setting. Why? What's the value of the athletic trainer?
Sure.
30-second elevator pitch.
Yeah. So ATs are healthcare, and so it's hard to believe that any level of sport would be able to go on without the services of a healthcare provider. And the person that's most uniquely qualified to provide that point of care, from acute management, obviously prevention prior to, but then, rehabilitation and all the way through the continuum of care, is the athletic trainer. And so from the standpoint of youth safety and risk mitigation, the value of the athletic trainer is really incredible.
Perfect. Brian, I'm going to go back to you because I missed the opportunity. If somebody wanted to gain some more information about the foundation or be able to contact you or talk with you to learn more, how do they get in touch with you, and where do they go to learn more about the foundation?
Well, I'm glad you asked. We actually went live with our new website yesterday. So natafoundation.org. On there you can contact. We have two dedicated employees that are unbelievable, that probably can answer any question anybody wants in regards to research and education. But if they want to contact me directly, it's best through my work email, which is brianconway@texashealth.org.
And before we go, and I make a plug for the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program, I just want to point something out that I think is very unique. Brian, what's your current practice setting?
I'm an administrator in a hospital-based sports medicine program.
Leslie, you're the director of the Master of Athletic Training Program at the Texas Tech Health Science Center, correct?
Correct.
So that is involved in medicine. Rusty, what's your current practice setting?
I'm the sports medicine coordinator at Nebraska Medicine, so I am in clinic and hospital.
Tori, what's your current practice setting?
Collegiate setting, as the director of athletic training services and healthcare administrator at Northwestern University.
So my point is, right, this is what we're looking at here, is that the leaders of our respective organizations are all very, they're all very progressive about where athletic training is and where it's going, not where it was, but where it is and where it's going, where it should be, that they're all in leadership positions in healthcare. So when you talk about ATs or healthcare, if I look at Brian, Leslie, Rusty, and Tori, they all are in what medicine looks like and how we all fit in.
This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/governingbodies. So I'll have links to the stuff that they mentioned, their emails, ways to contact each of our four guests. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/governingbodies. Each of the people that joined live watching on Facebook, I believe I mentioned you. If you're watching live on YouTube, I didn't catch you. Of course, I couldn't have done this without Josh Yellen, Craig Lewin checking in there at the last minute. And then I want to mention my partners, Dragonfly Max, Hoist Hydration, Myotech, Frio Hydration. All those help me keep the website up and running. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/governingbodies. Great conversation. And me in the secondary setting, no, I'm not actually BOC certified. I was, and it was my own fault that I lost that because I didn't keep up with paperwork. And I'm an associate member of the NATA, right? Because I believe in what we're doing, where we're going. I don't have a master's. So this isn't just like, follow me. It's like, guys, I screwed up. Don't follow me, right? And so I really appreciate all the work you guys are doing, being willing to jump on the podcast and share, and then where we're headed, because I believe in the future of athletic training is not yesterday, but it's tomorrow. All right. Thanks, guys.